Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, what's up, man?
Hello.
Doing well? Feeling good?
Hang it in. Shout out Vic Fangio. So we'll see what that looks like in Philadelphia. But, doing all right. Fun week of hoops so far. A lot of antics, a lot of buzzer beaters, a lot of big scoring. But, man, listen. So we record on Monday afternoons for the YouTube episodes that drop on every Tuesday. Normally it's just like, I hope we don't miss like a transaction or something on Monday night that we can't react to or whatever. Dog, we record Monday afternoon, then Joel Embiid drops 70.
Yeah.
And Cat drops 60 plus in a loss. Yeah. And then what, on Tuesday, we get the Rozier trade?
Tuesday, everything hits, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you feel?
That's pretty interesting. So
in real time, how'd you feel?
Screaming internally.
Okay, that man was
kind of the bit.
That man was trying to re-record.
Yes! Steve's like, nah, dog, we'll get it later in the week. And sure enough, we will indeed get to all of the fun things. Just quick hat tips to Joel Embiid. Quick hat tips to Karl Anthony Towns. Do we give the hat tip to Chris Finch for the bars and then the hold on, maybe I ain't mean to do all that?
Yeah, salute to Chris Finch. Man, that defense wasn't where he wanted to be. He wanted to make sure he set that correct. And then he also realized, I need to set this correct. And he did it all. They beat the Wizards. And apparently he passed the pain on.
Boy, did he. We'll get to that too. Let's start on the W front, as we briefly touched on like the Jordan Canada thing at the end of the last pod, but boy, that we had some things come through the pipeline since we recorded on Monday afternoon. First, we'll start the New York Liberty. We talked about the core designation that Breonna Stewart got. She's not going anywhere. She will very much be a member of the New York Liberty next season. Jonquel Jones, also an unrestricted free agent, but per reporting from the Next, Jonquel Jones is expected to re-sign with the Liberty, so it appears that she isn't going anywhere either. Averaged 11-4 last year, was better in the second half of the year. She got healthier and got more acclimated to her role on both ends with the Liberty, and was pretty dominant in the postseason for the Liberty last season. So obviously, if you can retain that type of talent to build on what you had last year, you do so.
Oh, buddy, a complete moment to exhale if you are a Liberty fan. The one thing, as you mentioned the stats, as Jonquel got healthy and really found her way, the Liberty looked like a completely different team. And there's no way you can talk about Jonquel and the Liberty without recognizing how important she is to the success of that team on both ends of the floor, being able to execute a variety of schemes defensively, the help defense in the paint, offensively being able to make shots, drive, score in the post, put pressure on teams, whatever sauce they found. The recipe does not work without Jonquel. And if they're trying to make another go of it, with some pieces they need to try and find to add to continue to compete at that high level, they needed to bring Jonquel back. So that is a plus for the Liberty.
And they may not be done, apparently, which leads into one of the bigger news breaks of the week coming yesterday. From Ramona Shelburne of ESPN, Neko Gumake informed the Sparks on Wednesday that she plans to play elsewhere. She will not be returning to the Sparks. Storied career with that franchise, won championships, was an MVP. And now she's testing, not just testing the waters, but will be playing elsewhere. She has already met with the Sparks, I would assume, to give the notification that she's not coming back. But she's also met with the Dream, the Mercury, and Chicago Sky. She also plans to meet with the Liberty and the Storm before making her decision. One, what is the shock factor for you? And then two, what are the top landing spots for her in your opinion?
High shock factor for me. Maybe it shouldn't be. I think this is the one tricky part with W free agency. Like, I'm glad we did the preview last week, but there's always a curveball that changes everything. So in your mind, you're thinking of these teams in a certain concept, or okay, what do they add? Oh, we're assuming this person's coming back. And then boom, 12 years, NECA is out of there. And now it's a whole different element to the mix. And now we start to see which domino falls first, who adds to what on top of it. I'm not sure. I was stunned. I was not prepared for it. Maybe the Jordan Canada core makes more sense now, since the Sparks are now going to have to figure out a new way to light things up in LA, so to speak. Little rebuild, little refresh, little retool. But yeah, the core from that championship run is gone. The torch is not going to be passed. It's going to be picked up. So we'll see how the Sparks do it. Side note, before I get to the landing spot, it is very weird to have the Mystics and the Sparks both about to look so different so quickly. Like, it kind of always felt like they would be in that Connecticut Sun territory. Not in a disrespectful way, but like, okay, we know what this is. Can they retool it or whatever? And now both of them are going to have to go in a completely different direction. And that's going to make the season very fun. As far as landing spots, I would assume, considering NECA has won a title, won an MVP, 8-time All-Star, winning would be the priority. And that list of teams is very interesting, because I don't necessarily think there's a bad one. It's just which situation would be the best. I imagine you will have some dream thoughts, but she can help elevate that team. That's a heck of a trio. Chicago, lowest of lows. You have Kalia Copper, you have Marina Mabry, you add NECA. Hey, all of a sudden we're back in the game. I'd still say don't ever sleep on the Phoenix Mercury. Like, I'm just throwing my hands in the air. They leave me here with something.
They are going to be trying for presumably Diana Taurasi's last year.
Mm-hmm. The Storm intrigue me. I just wonder, with the amount of teams and the landscape, are they close enough timeline-wise? Like, I can get down with NECA and Jewel Lloyd and Ezzie Mabigour, but are you climbing enough rungs there to really make the kind of impact you want? That the Liberty one intrigues me. Now, I don't think it happens, but buddy, I will be seated.
Can definitely see the intrigue there. I think for me, it's what you said, like with Seattle in particular, like, can you climb enough rungs? Like, trying to conceptualize NECA's free agency is weird, for lack of a better way to phrase it. Because as you alluded to at our preview, I think we came up off rip. Like, okay, Stewie's a free agent. We know she isn't going anywhere. NECA's a free agent, but we don't think she's going anywhere. John Quayle's very unlikely that she goes anywhere. And I think I made I said the specific sentence. Like, I think this really starts with Skylar Diggins-Smith as the blessed player that we know for a fact she will not be returning to her team. NECA now being on this list is just interesting. Because of how good she is, because of how versatile she is on both ends of the floor, there isn't a basketball team in which she does not fit. So I just think about, like, who has what, who's close enough to winning, who has the cap space? Because I think with the Liberty in particular, they have the win now situation. I don't know if they have unless someone takes a pay cut that neither of us are anticipating, and that's not off the table. But unless that happens, it's hard to think about, okay, how exactly do they fit in bringing Stewie back, which she will once again be below her max, bringing John Quayle back, she will be below her max, and then also fitting in NECA and trying to round out the bench from there. It just gets tough. Not impossible, but it gets tough. As we were talking about, we talked about it briefly in the watch party yesterday, I brought up Washington. That'll be interesting with, you know, with relation to Elena Delladine, where she ends up going if she's traded. But I think of Washington just because of what that core has been defensively, how good the Mystics have generally been when healthy. And then I also think about what NECA means to the league off the court. And, like, does her being in D.C. help with any of the other efforts that she may want to have, that she may want to tap into, or what she's already doing? And, like, a similar boat to Shanae, if they're still, like, a quote-unquote package deal. And Shanae is now doing things for the White House on top of that. So, like, maybe Washington perks up as a landing spot for those reasons as well. I'm intrigued by Chicago and Seattle getting in the mix on this. Because both of them, Chicago with Kalia Copper, Seattle with Jewel Lloyd, they have, like, the established guard / perimeter star. And they also have a whole lot of cap space. And they also have coaches that are former players, coaches that I think will command the respect of NECA on top of all of that. And Noel Quinn in Seattle, Teresa Weatherspoon going to Chicago now. The fact that they have the cap space and quietly a point guard need with Chicago, depending on what happens with Courtney Williams, the fact that both of them are kind of set up to say, hey, we could get you, NECA, and also get Skylar. Or basically use the one to help recruit the other. Going into the meetings with Skylar, like, hey, we may be able to get NECA if you commit. And vice versa. Like, that gets really interesting with those two teams in particular. Like, I would honestly keep an eye on Chicago on this. That would be interesting to me.
You do not give any dream bars.
I was just going to let that rock because Atlanta's probably my favorite landing spot for NECA. And Atlanta would also operate as a team that could, in theory, get NECA and Skylar, just in terms of the cap space, or being able to move a contract and getting there. I would be in on Atlanta landing NECA. If you have the front court of Cheyenne Parker and NECA, you also have Ryan Howard and Alicia Gray. If you're able to add Skylar, or if you get Jordan Canada, who we'll get to her shortly, or even if you just believe Ari McDonald with a healthier season can be the two-way point guard that they need, that's a really good, fun core that can grow together. I think that would be a wonderful fit. But we'll see. But to your earlier point, like, if she is just prioritizing the winning, how close is Atlanta? Like, if this just comes down to New York, depending on how much of a discount she has to take, Washington, and the Liberty, like, I mean, I don't know if Atlanta could get in versus Washington and New York. I think I said the Liberty twice there, but yeah. Like, I think it's a little tough there, but man, I did not anticipate thinking about NECA in a different uniform. And so to answer my earlier question up top, like, my shot scale was like 12 out of 10. I just didn't see it. But we will see where they go from there. As we briefly mentioned, Elena Deladon, Christina Williams reported that the Mercury are indeed one of the teams to express interest in trading for her. And to follow up reporting from her is that the Mystics are seeking draft compensation as part of a potential deal there. So one, hat tip to Christina. Two, hat tip to Steve, who has called this. It's just kind of reading, hey, Phoenix probably wants to make some big moves. They already did so on the coaching front, in the front office front. They got money to play with. Brittany Griner, another free agent, but one that we very much expect to be back. Would not surprise any of us that they will try to make a big splash and try to win immediately. And sure enough, we have real deal reporting on Elena Deladon as a Mercury target.
All I know about Phoenix is they are leaving there with something. That is my gut feel, so I'll do that. Now, can I be futuristically, respectfully messy?
Sure.
So which draft capital trade are you going to be happier about? The EDD one or the Marina Mabry one?
For which side, I guess, is my question.
The team that traded picks.
I would need to see what picks and how many picks go out the door for Elena Deladon. But like, off rip, man, Chicago gave up. So I don't want to rehash the whole thing. That's a whole lot of capital.
Hey, dunkers out there, go ahead and pre-order the Nekias rant that's coming. It'll be available for download soon.
Man, listen, we gonna see what happens there. As we briefly talked about Jordan Canada in Atlanta, some reporting from the committee and Christina Williams followed up with some extra stuff. There is mutual interest between the Atlanta Dream and Jordan Canada. So potential landing spot there, as we talked about on the last pod. And going back to the pod before that one, the Sparks did core Jordan Canada. For those who aren't familiar, it's essentially a one-year deal up to the Supermax. It operates like the franchise tag in the NFL, if you aren't super familiar. There's more that goes into it, but if you just want the quick view. Basically a one-year deal for Jordan Canada. But as ESPN's Andrea Carter reported, it is expected that she seeks a sign and trade from the Sparks. And now with this NECA news, that probably makes a little bit more sense. Maybe the Sparks in general are just going in a different direction. I love the Atlanta fit for Jordan Canada, if they're able to make something shake there. But we will keep an eye on that one. More reporting from Christina Williams. The Sparks, the Aces, the Storm, and the Dream are among the teams. And also the Indiana Fever are among the teams to express interest in center Kalani Brown, who really played well second half of the year for the Dallas Wings, averaged career highs in points, rebounds, assists, and minutes last year. She averaged 11 and 9 in five starts. but was a productive bench player for the Wings. Steve, do you like any of those teams in particular for Kalani Brown?
The biggest thing for me is just nice to see the work that she put in last year after being a training camp contract and being able to come back on the hardship deal and contribute to the Wings payoff. Of those teams, it's very interesting to see the mix as far as, hey, you can contribute. The Sparks intrigue me, but that's also because I don't know what the Sparks are going to be. So that might be the most opportunity, quote unquote. The Aces seems fun as far as a backup big. I might lean the Storm here, in all honesty. I feel like that size, rebound, and screening would pop there. I think that could be intriguing. What say you?
I don't know, because like I guess I just wonder like how I feel about Kalani Brown starter somewhere. I think offensively it's very easy to foresee what kind of impact she can have as a post threat, as an offensive rebounder, someone that kind of flash some of the mid-range scoring. So that's interesting to me. Defense can provide a presence at the rim. A little bit more mobility than you would anticipate, but I still wouldn't say she's like super scheme versatile right now. I'm intrigued by the Storm, but like also I want Ezzy to just be a five. Because of how good she is, I flank her with a real four, please. Or just let Jordan Horston play your four and kind of grow into that. So I don't really want to disrupt that. Storm's interesting. The Dream are interesting, especially in light of Ileana Rupaire. She's not going to be playing for the Dream this year. She's taking the year off from the W to prepare for international play / Olympic play. So like maybe Atlanta works as like a high minute second big or super sub, depending on what else happens in free agency with them. Like I can get with Atlanta. Honestly, this feels like a lot of, hey, Dallas, I know you appreciate her. However, we can go elsewhere if you don't pony up. So I wonder if this all just turns into the Wings have given her like a real contract that she enjoys. So I guess we will see what happens on that front. So this concludes a quote-unquote quick in Dunker Hours, Dunker Verbiage. Free agency update on the W side. On the NBA side, because, buddy, do we have some things to sort through. I think the quickest thing to get through, Tristan Thompson being suspended for 25 games. Did not have that on the bingo card. I don't have any real thoughts there outside of that's kind of wild. We will see if there is an appeal at any point. I guess we'll keep everyone updated on that front. But to the coaching side, as we've gotten some real movement there. The Bucks fired Adrian Griffin. After 43 games, a 30-13 record, which currently has him tied for the third best record in NBA history. So that's an interesting fun fact. You want to have that for trivia. They plan to hire Doc Rivers. The contract being talked through right now will go through the 2026-27 season around the $40 million salary range, which is lots of money. Steve, how surprised were you that the Bucks made this move midseason? And I guess just your general thoughts on his job and what you anticipate coming from Doc Rivers.
Extremely surprised, Nikias. It was a massive wow for me, and I will take you and the listeners on a journey and hopefully break this down and it makes sense. We'll just kind of carry it out and go. Year one, Nikias. Year one on the gig. Year one, 30-13, the number two seed in the East. At that time, I believe it was tied or was the second best record in the NBA. Number two offensive rating, literally about to coach the All-Star game. Gone. Over. Done. Not year two with this team. Gone. It's over. Took a lot for me to process that in my brain because that's just not how it's supposed to work. Even though you know how important relationships are and leadership and championship expectations and star players and all that. Literally, my brain had to lock in on how did that happen? And there's been a lot of noise with Griffin and the Bucks and Bucks fans and talking about the disastrous effects of the job or how bad he's done. And I take that with a grain of salt because at some point it becomes very easy to point to coaches and what they are not doing or fail to do. But some of the same people cannot or do not or will not point to the things that they have done well to balance things out and to give a full understanding of what's going on. I didn't think it would end this quickly, in all honesty. I didn't think that mm-hmm. would happen year one. I mean, if they were 23 and 21, hey, I probably get it. But mm-hmm. to not be able to carry out the end of your vision or feel like you're close, you know, just in my mind, I'm thinking that's pretty tough. I understood the noise. I got it. But I understood some of the moves that Coach Griffin was trying to make. As far as we go defensively, trying to add more scheme versatility to have different options or coverages when it comes to playoff time. Making sure Brooke can do multiple, Portis can be at the level or switch, Giannis can be at the level or switch. I think the optics did not help him a single bit. Where, you know, everyone in their analysis for the most part had a, hey, there's going to be a trade-off. The Bucks are going to be a whole lot better offensively. The defense is going to take a hit. The way the defense took a hit was something that I feel like everyone could see. It was loud. That's a problem. And I think the optics of the Bucks defense being where it was, you know, I mentioned it early in the season. I think it was a Toronto game. I was like, I'm not sure they know what their base is right now. Because I was looking at Brooke and I was like, sometimes he's in a drop and sometimes he's in between and sometimes he's at the level and that's not ideal. Like, if you're going to be bad, you'd be bad within a vacuum. It can't be all of that. And you combine that with the players saying, hey, we should probably go back to drop with Brooke. And Coach Griffin be like, you know what? You're right. And it looks better. Because of the noise, does he get the benefit of the doubt for listening to his players or did he cave? I'll ask that.
I think for a lot of people, it's probably the latter.
Okay. Let's see. This is where we...
Or at the very least, like the backdrop of... He shouldn't have even had to be told to not have Brooke at the level because of what Brooke did last year, et cetera.
And see, that's where if I wanted to, we could dive into a larger talk about coaching and experimentation and tinkering and adjustments, but we'll leave that where it is. I understood not solely relying on Dame and Giannis in pick and roll or Dame and Giannis screening actions and trying to build a base that increased your pressure points, that allowed you to play offense. You established Dame and Brooke together. You still got Giannis and Chris. You could do other things. We can also mix that in. That felt like a positive for the team overall long-term. The issue is the noise got louder. The issues didn't necessarily feel different. The base, it never felt like the base was there night in, night out defensively. And offensively, while they had great success, could they generate different shots? Could they execute on different nights where shots weren't falling? There were question marks. I personally had reached a point where I think the offense was in a good place. They can tinker some things. I think a couple more sets. And then defensively, if you can just show some help, close out, keep the ball in front, you give yourself a shot. And then I paused once this happened, right? I know I'm all over the place. My mind went back to the Terry Stotts exit. And we talked about it in the moment when it happened, and it felt odd timing-wise. And you had a scenario, and I'm not going to dive too much into the speculation of things that we've heard or been revealed to us. You can read about them on your own, because we don't have confirmation. But usually if a first-year head coach is there, they want experience on the bench. That didn't work. Stotts was there to provide that experience, had the relationship with Dame. Who knows what he could have or was going to do for the offense. That turning into a, you know what, you got it scenario instead of a let's figure it out scenario. Especially considering how much things had changed for Milwaukee expectation-wise, just stuck in the back of my mind, right? And it's just like, what do I do? How do I process this? Actually, I'll talk about that real quick.
Okay.
Because it all kind of blends together a little bit. When you have a former head coach with a newer head coach who had been assistant, could be a hire from the front office, maybe not. It creates a different dynamic. And how do we also balance just the job changing, right? And how much of an impact that has. And I didn't want to go too much into like speculation, but there was a key piece from Ramona Shelburne's article in which it mentioned how impressed the Bucks brass were with Adrian Griffin's defensive mindset, how he sold them on improving the defense. And it's a reminder, he interviewed with Giannis, Chris Middleton, and Drew Holiday, not Damian Lillard. The job changed once they got Damian Lillard. The expectations changed, the mindset changed, the team changed. And as we mentioned that trade-off, yeah, you got it, but at the same time, there was a stat that I saw on the Bucks broadcast yesterday, which, of course, I would see it there. Bucks defensive rating 13th in December. Bucks defensive rating in January 28th. Hey, man. You brought me to this pod for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what reason. Don't tell me. But...
Let's say
whichever reason it was a great analysis or whatever, I just wasn't hitting that. And you sitting there like, hey, this is cool, but hey, my whole career's on the line, big dog. What you I didn't invite you here for all this. Like this is fine, but I need this over here. How does that play into it? You know? Mm-hmm. What were your first thoughts? I know I've gone on a weaving rant of sorts.
Oh no, you're good. And I want to, oh no, I love when you tap into this side. And like this, it threw me off because like we watched the Bucks on our own time. We watched the Bucks during the watch parties. We have Buck fans in the watch party to where we can get like different perspectives from people that like watch the team literally every game and understand those intricacies and stuff. And so like, I don't think either of us were like removed from some of the noise about what Adrian Griffin was doing. And like, I think we both kind of had to separate, okay, fans generally just don't like their coaches unless they're the best coach. And even then, as someone that's been in Heat Twitter for over a decade, I have seen all of the opinions on Eric Spoelstra. And we mostly agree that he is at worst a top three coach in basketball. And so, like, coaches are never exempt from, like, fan talk. So it's us trying to parse through, okay, how much of this is frustration with team / coach because you are a fan, that's generally how it goes, versus this might be a problem. And this may be part of a bigger thing that could pop at any moment. And so, like, I was surprised just by pure volume of 43 games is not a lot of time. And aside from... there is something happening behind the scenes, whether that's in the locker room or just completely off court, whatever. Independent of finding something out like that out, 43 games is just not a lot. And it's wild to see someone get fired that quickly into a job like this. Especially when you factor in, it hasn't looked great, it hasn't looked smooth. They're 30-13 in the Griffin era. It shocked me. And so I started thinking about the defense first and foremost, because that's obviously the loudest portion. That's the worst side of the ball for Milwaukee. And I was just looking at different numbers, like, okay, cool. What's their defensive rating? Where do they rank? What's their defensive rating without garbage time? What's their half-court defense looking like? What's the transition defense looking like? And it's just like, okay, how much of this is the expected dip when you go from Drew Holiday and Javon Carter off the bench? If we just talk about the total point of attack thing, like you can't discount that part either. How much of it is Drew's not there, Javon's not there, Pat Connaughton is no stopper, but Pat hasn't been the same Pat this year. How much of it is that versus Adrian is trying to do things that doesn't fit this personnel group, even if the intentions are there to improve that versatility, et cetera. He's trying things that will not work with this personnel group, and he has to take some of that hit. I was struggling with trying to find that balance as I was thinking about what he's been doing this year. We go to the offense, which, again, they second best offensive rating in the league. The Damian Giannis thing that we've talked about on the pod through watch parties, et cetera. And it's like, okay, let me see if I can get some numbers behind this. I know how I feel about it. Like, I think I think it is a pairing that obviously fits on paper. That's why I was so excited about it when it came in. And because I've been doing this podcast with you for over 3 years now, I also got now had it in my mind, like, okay, I understand that they're probably not going to just come out the gate and run this 45, 50 times a game between pick and rolls, handoffs, et cetera. So I don't expect that. And I'm kind of okay with them just not spamming because they want to build out a broader thing. But that led me, in light of like Doc Rivers being announced and then not announced and then announced and then kind of announced and then ultimately announced as the new head coach, I was like, okay, let's look at some numbers here. Like, what is Dame Giannis looking like compared to like the Harden and Embiid thing? How often was Philadelphia running pick and roll as a whole? And then just kind of cycling on like, okay, what exactly were the duos doing? And so went to Second Spectrum. It's like, okay, let's get the Dame Giannis pick and roll or the Giannis Dame pick and roll, whatever they inverted. Let's get the handoffs. Let me try to get like a two-man game number for these two compared to Harden and Embiid from last year. You add it up. Dame and Giannis, you get about 14 possessions a game. Between Giannis screening for Dame, Dame screening for Giannis, handoffs for Giannis, between those two, about 14 a game. For Harden and Embiid, it was 25.3. Massive gap. And from there, my thought bubble was like, okay, I don't expect this to be spammed for obvious, well, not, I don't say obvious reasons, but I don't expect this to be spammed. Is there a middle ground that can be found between the sometimes static Harden and Embiid thing that we saw last year? And I say static just in terms of this is the foundation. Is there a middle ground between doing it to that degree and 14 times a game probably not being enough? So that's where I was looking like, okay, like there's probably room for this to maybe don't need to be 25 a game like Harden and Embiid was. And if you want to get into like specific numbers, Harden and Embiid, over 1,100 picks between the two last year. Tied for first with Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton last year. And they were way more efficient than the Chris Paul, DeAndre Ayton combo last year. So like there was reason for them to spam pick and roll the way that they did. Because they were very freaking good at it. And we talked about those counters and the adjustments they made throughout the year in last season's podcast. So don't want to rehash all of that, but it made sense. And I was like, okay, could this go from 14 to 18? And does that give you room for that pairing, which statistically has got off to a really cold start? And we talked about that on the pod. Now they're over 1.1 points per possession on any trip featuring a Dame Giannis pick and roll. So it's good. I think there are some nuances that they have to get better at. And you've hit on those. And honestly, I'll let you get those out. So I have my own notes on that. But I know that you have wanted to bring up the point that, hey, this chemistry isn't all the way where it needs to be yet. So I'll defer to you on that front before I get into like what I've seen on that. But is there room for a little bit more? Like, probably.
Well,
and like, is that some of the angst that maybe Bucks brass felt with the offense, even though it was good?
I feel like if we're talking angst, then we'll deliver a criticism because I think it's fair. Did it feel different? Did you feel differently about what was happening, or were you just winning games? Is there a point where in your defense is all you have the record? Now, I still think it's wild. But at the same time, defensively, yes, we're changing schemes. We have different things. Did the help feel better? Did the closeouts feel better? Did the multiple efforts feel better? Or were the same breakdowns the same breakdowns? Offensively, you're running flex. Cool. You've got the double high pick and roll for Dame. Cool. You got Dame Giannis pick and roll. Cool. You have Giannis Chris pick and roll. Cool. What are we flowing into afterwards? How many Dremel handoffs are we getting? What's our base? I feel like the base just wasn't strong enough to support some of the errors. So I will lean into that criticism. As far as Dame Giannis stuff, there's a lot they can do, honestly. And if you go back to the preseason, there's a lot they were doing. As far as elbow action, Dame is the screener for Giannis. Off-ball action, those two are screeners. Inverted pick and roll. There's meat that's been left off the bone. My pushback has always been, I don't think just spamming that button is the answer for everything the Bucks may need offensively and could actively harm them, mainly because they haven't quite got their chemistry down yet, where sometimes they set that pick and roll. Okay, is Dame rejecting? Is Dame rolling hard? Is Dame looking to snake because he sees the defense back? And then Giannis is rolling into that space. Nothing that's not correctable, but just something that, hey, they need to work those kinks out. So this isn't something that's going to take them from, you know, A1 to A111 or whatever a higher number is. that's mainly my point with it, which I also will find very, very, very ironic. Because there are people who said the Sixers lacked creativity offensively last year or relied too much on Harden and Bean pick and roll and are going to point to the Bucks spamming Dame and Giannis pick and roll as a plus. I'm prepared to laugh. I just want you to know that out there. I'm prepared to laugh. I'm prepared to laugh. It ties into an overall coaching rant that I have where do y'all forget some of the things that y'all say about some of these coaches? Because I distinctly remember a whole lot of noise about Ime Udoka in Boston at the start, and that was flipped as positive as he went to Houston. And I'm like, hey, can I get a little bit of consistency here? Can I get a little bit of consistency here? We'll save that rant. But I think organically, if we're talking Doc, probably the biggest work is just get the buy-in. Get the buy-in defensively. That's another thing. I get yelled at by Bucks fans a lot about, well, they don't have point of attack defenders. And, well, how are you going to craft a defense? Look, pals, friends, folks, if you get gear that has a team logo on it, you cannot walk into that building and be like, well, y'all can't play defense. Guess it's just cooked. No, your job is to figure out how to make that work. That's the part that people don't understand in this whole discourse and back and forth. Oh, well, no, Malik Beasley's guarding the best player. Malik Beasley shoots very well. He helps our spacing. If we can just get enough out of him defensively, look at what we got. That's the point. That's the purpose. For Milwaukee, it's about hammering home the little things. Can we do a better job of showing help early? We may not be the best group at keeping the ball in front. We might not have the quote-unquote point of attack defenders to be able to keep the ball in front all the time. How do we navigate that? Show our bodies early. We recover. We keep the ball in front. Contain, contest. How much does that solve for Milwaukee? And then offensively, hey,
I'd imagine
we got pressure points. How much does moving the ball from side to side with purpose just help us? For me, it's get more purpose in the building. That's simple as that for me.
I think that's fair. Like, and I think with, that's with the defense in particular, like, I am curious to see just what that looks like. Like, will we see a boost in the defense just because they have the buy-in from Doc, if they're able to get it? And we don't see, like, a dramatic scheme shift from Milwaukee. Like, I guess I just wonder, like, what is, if they do get the buy-in from Doc and they believe in him in a way they didn't believe in Adrian Griffin, how much of that alone will get the defense from 20, will that get that defense from 22nd to 16th? And if it is 16th, with the offense being as good as it is, does that eliminate the, I think they're gonna hunt around for better defense before the trade deadline. I think that's just something they're gonna do. But like, does that mitigate at least some of the desperation there if Doc has them playing harder, etc.?
I think it gets them into a safer zone. You clean up a little bit of that transition defense. You clean up just a little bit of the self-inflicted stuff in the half court. Value possessions a little bit more. I think they look different.
Makes sense. And the transition defense in particular, like, per clean the glass, no team defends a higher percentage of possessions in transition than the Milwaukee Bucks do. And that is not generally a thing that happens to Milwaukee. And, like, some of that is, I don't know, it just feels like there's a comfort with teams. Like, okay, even after a mate, we can get this up early and get something before they get set. Because to your point, their help isn't going to be in all the time. And it just feels like some of it is just I'm not going to do the voice, but, like, some of it is, like, the drop in effectiveness at the point of attack. But, like, they've put a whole lot on Brook this year in a way that I didn't even feel it last year. And this is with Brook leading the NBA in contested shots by a wide margin last year. It feels like he has to clean up a whole lot this year. And I do wonder just how much better that gets if they are able to get back in a better way, if they are able to show their help a little bit earlier. So now Brook isn't tasked with saving as many possessions as he has to. Because, like, I've gone through, I feel like, a whole lot of rabbit holes this week. Because we had trade stuff, we're getting that, et cetera. I've watched so many Terry Rozier passes. It's pitiful. But anyway, I was watching a whole bunch of transition clips from Milwaukee's defense. And so much of it is just, we take shot. They're They're bottom six in offensive rebound rate this year. So it's not even like they're crashing the glass and then just getting blitzed on the other end. It is, we take shot, we stare at ball, we linger in the corner. And now it is Malik Beasley defending a 3-on-1. And it's just like, guys, it's already Malik Beasley, with all due respect, because that man has tried this year. But like, it's already Malik Beasley. Now you're just saying, say, be 2013 Danny Green in transition? That's not fair. That is not fair to him. That's not fair to him. And to that point, like, that's where I wonder, as someone that's not in the building, someone who has zero coaching experience, like, is that just the buy-in portion that you talk about? Because, like, I feel like watching, I should not have to tell someone who is spacing on a possession, hey, go ahead and start retreating backwards so you can make your life easier. Like, I don't think a coach should have to tell a player that. And so, like, is that just we should hold players accountable for Milwaukee being this in transition? Or is this something that Adrian Griffin tried to hammer home or didn't try to hammer home enough? And this is why it's this. Like, I genuinely don't know. But I see stuff like that on film, and it's just like, I don't know what to, who do you even blame on that?
Well, I mean, you hold the players accountable, but again, ideally, we talk about buy-in all the time. If you have that buy-in, they're holding themselves accountable for those breakdowns, for those errors. And you'll see that, you know, not to cut you off, but for Milwaukee, it's about sustaining defense. How many times have we seen a great switch between Dame and Malik Beasley? And then here comes the screen. And it's like, well, what's the screen navigation going to look like? Oh, they did it that time. Cool. Oh, wait. The help is in too far. Oh, no. The closeout is bad.
Swing to corner.
Oh, no. That is what they need to clean up. Avoid the breakdown. And for me, I guess it's going to be interesting to see, is it more simplified? Does Giannis feel more comfortable in it? Does he now become to being a menace on the weak side? Like, have you felt Giannis on the weak side this year?
Not to the degree that I normally do.
And so part of my...
I feel like that's something that we talked about, like, in passing earlier this year. It's like, hey, man. I think it was you. It was like, hey, well, what's up with Giannis so far?
Part of my head was like, okay, it's new stuff. He's more involved on ball because he has to be. I get it. But then sometimes I'm looking at the help. I'm like, this doesn't seem like it used to be. Like, hey, what's going on there? But yeah, I think a lot of that can be tied to them just getting some overall improvement.
Some of the effort stuff. I'm not going to get into like super processed brain and being annoyed, but like you know how that kind of stuff drives me up a wall. Like some of the stuff can just be fixed by hashtag have some pride. Like just get back on defense, especially since you aren't the super we send the three to the offensive glass to create extra possessions. Like, you really have no excuse to be in the bottom of offensive rebound rate and then also give up transition possessions at a higher clip than anybody else in the league. Like, it can't be both of those things. I'm sorry. That just can't be the thing. But as you talk about simplifying things on defense, just circle quickly back to the offensive side. Like, I think the pick and roll thing is going to be an easy thing for people to point to with Milwaukee. Just looking up very quickly, they were 27th in, like, picks per 100%, or pick and rolls per 100 possessions last year. They were up 220th this year, which is still low. The Philadelphia 76ers were first last year under Doc Rivers with the James Harden, Joel Embiid partnership. And funny enough, in the win against Cleveland last night for Milwaukee, 77 on-ball picks for them, which was their second highest total of their season. So it's just like, huh, is this already going to be the quickest shift that we see with Milwaukee's defense? I mean, with Milwaukee's offense. So I'm just keeping an eye on that front. But
yeah, keeping an eye on it. I think if they can be a little bit more organized in the half court, they can just lean on a few more counters and develop some of those things. And they've got the early offense portion. I think they got the flow portion to a degree. Now you just got to tie things up. But yeah, it's just they are very serious about winning a championship. And they got a window to do it. And we'll see if Doc can get it done. I do think it is kind of funny, no disrespect, Bucks fans, that you wanted Bud gone, and then you immediately wanted Griffin gone, and the answer ended up being Doc Rivers. And some of y'all just got to go ahead and delete some tweets.
Sound like some of the Bucks fans don't want him either. It's like, well, you can't have... At a certain point, you just got... Hey, if we go to a restaurant and you suggest three different things, you don't want it. At some point, you just getting water and chicken strips. Like, I'm sorry. It's just kind of tough for you. But anyway, while we're on the coaching front, Wes Unseld Jr. from the Washington Wizards, he is out as head coach. He's going to move to a front office role, at least for the rest of this season. Brian Keefe going to take over as the interim head coach for the remainder of the season. And afterwards, Washington will be seeking a coach with an extensive player, will be expected to seek a coach with an extensive player development track record when they conduct a wide offseason search. That's from Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN. Wizards were 77-130 under West, though obviously a whole lot of roster turnover there, as highlighted by the Bradley Beal trade that we got this offseason. As of recording, the Wizards are 25th in offense, 30th in defense, and 28th in net rating per clean the glass, so not a great season. Hasn't been the most fun tenure in year one of Jordan Poole era as well. Did you have any general thoughts on Wes Unseld?
Didn't see this one coming either. Did not see this one coming. The first thought in my head was, hey, didn't he just get his option picked up for the 24-25 season like 3 months ago? Like, isn't that a thing that just happened?
Yeah.
And it's something we kind of touched on where I figured in my head, this might not be the season, but next year is probably where the seat gets warmer. And hey, we need to see some progress. And apparently things changed. My shock was less performance-based. I think it's unfortunate. And I'll kind of dive into that a little bit. But this is a Wizards team that, A, is 2.5 games better than the Detroit Pistons. And B, recently lost to the Detroit Pistons. So, you know, kind of tough. I look at the whole tenure and I'm like, man. And it ties in. There's so many times where people are working their tails off to get an opportunity. And you look at the opportunity and how quickly that opportunity can shift. Like, you got to remember, what are they, 34-38 in the Westbrook Beal era? And so he comes in, you got the Beal, Kuzma, Dinwiddie, KCP era with Denny and Rui, and then Beal goes down. Then you have the Beal, Kuzma, Porzingis era, and then Beal's gone, and now it's Jordan Poole and Kyle Kuzma, and yeah. I think the thing is, the toughest part is the offense didn't feel as strong this year, the defense didn't feel as strong this year, and if you're preaching a new direction and continuity, and it goes bad, it's tough to overcome. I guess my biggest thing is, if you think about it, Nikias, Michael Winger shifted and got the leadership. And if there's one thing that is consistent in the league, basketball decision makers generally want
our guy.
They want to make sure they have their guy and his head coach. And he just got there this summer, and he may have just decided to expedite the process a little bit. You know, obviously under contract, I think due to the ties that the Unseld family has to that organization, I think this was done as respectfully as possible. I mean, heck, Wes Unseld Jr. started with the Wizards as a personnel scout. So, I mean, they go deep. But man, it's a lot of grind for Wes. All those years in Washington, Golden State, Orlando, Denver. You just look at some of the work that these folks are putting in, and it's tough.
It's really tough. And, like, I remember making the joke about it earlier this year with Washington, where I was talking about their help defense. And it's just like, on some of these possessions, everyone is super in and we are super aggressive. And why are all these openings available? And then on other possessions, it's y'all got it. It is 2v2, do your best. And they don't really have the personnel, outside of a couple guys on the roster I like, but like, they don't, overall, they don't have the personnel to defend like that. And it just feels like Wes tenure, not that he was a perfect coach, and like, Wizards fans can attest to that better than I can, but like, I would watch Wes over the past few years, especially when Beal was healthy, and it's like, okay, I like some of these things that he's running on offense. Like, this is some fun, creative stuff. I get it. Defensively, I see you trying to ramp it up, and I see you trying to dial it back down depending on who's on the floor. It just feels like he never really had the personnel healthy enough offensively for things to really pop for him. And he's just flat out never had the real personnel defensively. to do what he wanted. And without that, and then you throw in, again, injuries and you get trades and you throw all of that stuff on top of that. Just like, how are you supposed to establish something? Not to completely absolve them, but I look at it more like, this is unfortunate, and he didn't pass with an A+ grade more than Wes is the reason the Wizards were bad. Cause like I can't get there. And I feel like I said similar stuff with like James Borrego when he was fired in Charlotte. I was like, yeah, the defense is bad. It's not because he didn't try. They ran more zone than just about anyone during his last year there and stuff. Like, at a certain point, your personnel is your personnel. And I guess to the overall point, and so that you hit on with Adrian Griffin, like at a certain point, like if the buy-in isn't there, then maybe the effort really doesn't matter from your end. If the players don't believe and then it's all just bad, then at a certain point there has to be a shift, if for no other reason than just to get a different voice in the room and hope you can salvage some of it. So, like, Wes is someone, like, I hope he gets another opportunity somewhere else. Like, I would like to see him get an opportunity somewhere more stable. So, if for no other reason than just to get a clearer picture of this is his vision, it works or it doesn't. It just felt like he never really get a real run to see this works because of the personnel he had and then the availability of said personnel when he had it. That's kind of where I land as an outsider. Again, Wizards fans can yell at me if I'm missing some stuff, but that's kind of my view on it. Whole lot of coach talk on the pod. Let's get into some transactions on the NBA side. We did have a trade between the Heat and the Hornets, which maybe that's why James Borrego was in the mind. But Terry Rozier, you are a Miami Heat. Kyle Lowry and a 2027 first that's lottery protected will become unprotected in 2028. You are going to Charlotte. Kyle Lowry not expected to play for Charlotte, I would imagine. They try to work out a trade before the deadline, and if not, maybe it becomes buyout hours for Kyle Lowry. But Terry Rozier, at least entering last night's action, he did have 9 points, 4 boards, 5 assists off the bench for Miami in his debut. But heading into that game, he was averaging a career high and with 23.2 points, 53% on twos, 36% from three, 85% at the line, and 6.6 assists. What are some of your early thoughts? And I guess since we have a game under the belt, early impressions of Terry Rozier in Miami?
Well, that's the fun part. We both get to talk about the trade and kind of some of the early impressions that we have on it. My initial thought was, hey, the Heat made a move. And being able to add that type of score should help their offense, should help them in late game, should help Nekias not go on end of pod rants on the Miami Heat offense. But I guess we'll have to wait till next month for that. I think Terry Rozier's ability to self-create and to score jumped right off the page. There's one thing you've been looking for from Miami outside of like the big name that they're always attached to, it's that guard who has the ability to score and make defenses pay and potentially Nekias get them to the level of a screen and open things back up. Like, think about when Tyler Hero had his run, or Gabe Vincent's pull-ups and how important they were, or when Kyle Lowry had it in him and it was going, and the difference it made when Miami was able to take and make those shots, even Max Strus to a degree. Having Jimmy Bam, Terry, Tyler Hero, you should have some options late. You should have some fun lineup optionality. From my head, I was curious about the usage. But one thing that stood out to me, especially in Charlotte, Terry Rozier, very good at slipping guard pick and rolls. What is some of Miami's best offense? Hey, here's Jimmy Butler, and here's someone you don't want defending Jimmy Butler. They are now going to run action together. Enjoy. Hey, we can run some cool inverted stuff for Bam Adebayo. Enjoy. How much do they use him in some of their movement sets as far as being off ball, getting dribble handoffs? That's something my mind went to. After thinking all that, Nekias, guess what happened, buddy?
Go ahead.
I got into a rabbit hole of what does this actually mean? Are defenses actually going to cooperate? Are they actually going to come to the level or send help on the drives, or are, you know, they going to close out hard when he gets a kick? He'll take and make those shots. Will it shift anything for Miami? And then it came down to context. You know, for me in my head, it's not like he doesn't help Miami. It's hard to say they don't need the things that he does very well. How much do they need it from him? How good can he be for them? How much does the elevator change the Heat despite it being a good fit? That's where I got stuck. Like, how much of it is just the scoring elevates? How much of it is he'll shoot more than Kyle Lowry? How much is it is that we regain a piece of having that kind of guard that we lost with Gabe Vincent, and hopefully we can replicate some of the pieces we lose from Kyle Lowry? Is he a super sub? Is he a closer? Does he help the lineup versatility? There's a lot of thoughts going on in my head. Mm-hmm. Now, that was the other thing I had was defensively. And since we're going with initial thoughts, I was trapped, Nikias. I was battling between what we've seen recently in Charlotte against what we've seen in the past in Boston and what Spo can do for a player, what Miami can do for a player as far as buying goes. And Nikias, buddy, I'm going to let you get your initial thoughts off, but let me tell you, Spo talked about the competitive qualities of Terry Rozier. Terry Rozier talked about not wanting to step on any toes. That man's first possession, he came out with full court pressure. I was like, oh, he's locked in. What were your thoughts on the trade before we dive into the game?
Okay. Thoughts on the trade, you know, based on the end of pod rant that I gave about the weird Miami Januaries and clamoring for a deal that may or may not get done. And then, of course, Miami then trades for Terry Rozier. It's like, huh, well, this is refreshing. This is interesting. Kyle Lowry in the future first. If that's your price, then cool. I think it helps. I think between Kyle Lowry, at least post this injury, as he came back, like, he just did not have the same juice. And then even if you zoom out to the year, like, he just didn't have the same burst as a driver. I think his drives were still important. His intention on pushing the pace after misses or just hitting those, you know, throwing those quick hit aheads, I thought that was important for Miami, but it just didn't hit to the same degree. It just wasn't good enough. I think the defense was fine. But, like, fine plus air offensively, and then you get into some of the, lean on Heat Beat / Five on the Floor for some of the off, I guess, locker room stuff, I'd say, about like what the buy-in was like there and stuff like that. That's not my reporting. I let them have that portion. But like it just very much felt like, okay, the Lowry era probably just needs to end in Miami. Like, they need something different in the guard room. And so you can get Terry Rozier, who's averaging over 20 points, and he's averaging nearly 7 assists, and he's a guy that can knock down pull-ups. He's a guy that can get downhill and genuinely get downhill without a screen, which is something that Miami very much has been missing for the past couple of years. You see the immediate value add there. You have a more more potent scorer at the guard spot. And like at a very basic level, that should take pressure off of Tyler Hero to make decisions. That should take pressure off of Jimmy Butler during the regular season anyway, to where he doesn't have to score 25 a night. And with how Jimmy treats regular seasons, he doesn't want to do that anyway. And take some of the scoring onus off of Bam. Defensively, it was very much a which version are we getting? Because the Charlotte version, to be frank, or at least this season, hasn't been very good defensively. Off ball hasn't been clean. On ball, very much fight over an initial screen. If there's a second one, it's cooked. Charlotte's defense overall has been bad. So, like, I don't put that all on him, naturally. But it hasn't been the Rozier that we've seen in earlier iterations of the Charlotte tenure, and it certainly isn't the Rozier that we saw in Boston. So to your point, I am curious to see, do we just get fully fleshed? I don't have to put up as many shots as I did this year in Charlotte. / I want to be here, period, because I have so much respect for Spo and the Heat organization, Big D Wade guy, etc. Like, do we see him return more to like the Boston version of what we saw defensively? I think we can see that. So we'll see how much that means. But offensively, I found myself like, it's better. It's an obvious upgrade, but to your point of how much does it actually shift, I don't know. And I feel like I'm generally lower on it than a lot of people are because of that portion. Because I don't think Rozier is someone's very comfortable taking pull-ups. He can knock down threes. I don't know if he's at the level in which teams feel like they have to bring a guy to the level. And if not, is he just scoring against drop in a vacuum? Or is he scoring against switches in a vacuum? That helps. And for a Miami offense that is bottom 10 in the league in offensive rating and 28th in offensive rating in January for cleaning the glass, they need all the scoring help that they can get. So I don't want to poo-poo that. But as this Miami team is one with title aspirations still, is Terry Rozier going to bend defenses enough? I don't know. And that's where I appreciate the fact that he can get downhill at a level that Tyler Herro can't, a level that Kyle Lowry can't anymore. He hasn't been a good finisher throughout his career. So, like, to your point about how much are the drives going to bend defenses, I don't know. Because if I'm scouting against Miami, obviously you don't want to give up a layup line. But, like, I'm not sending the house on Terry Rozier drives. I'm making him finish over length. Because it isn't something that he's been able to consistently do throughout his NBA career. I think those drives can lead to more catch-and-shoot opportunities. But even then, it's like, how much help am I sending towards him? I think the threshold for Terry really shifting it to Miami can get out of the East is a little bit higher than I think a lot of people are giving credit to. And so it's very much, I don't know, I feel like it's like tamper expectations if you are a Heat fan, but also this is an upgrade. It's a positive trade, but like within a playoff slash we want to get to the finals again, lens, it's like, I need to see some things answered offensively.
Well, buddy, I'm glad you mentioned it because I was intrigued with his debut. I think a couple counters or just bouncing off what you said. Number one, in his debut, it really felt like he was trying to fit in. Really wanted to be a team sure player. Was. Like, I think the first play for him was a stagger. He kicked it right to Tyler Herro. And he went to go screen on someone in the corner instead of spacing. And it was like, hey, man, still be you. There's another play. I think he had a good drive. He kicked it to Duncan Robinson. And then Duncan Robinson came off the screen. And Caleb Martin was literally pointing to Terry Rozier like, hey, go to the top of the key. Your man is helping. Your man is helping. And Terry instead cut to the corner. And it was like, all right, man, we'll work the kinks out. I think the drives really popped right away for him in Miami. And I think that can help their drive and kick game, which they already get to naturally. But him getting kicks from Jimmy Butler, from Tyler Herro, being able to drive on his own, getting the paint, I think that's important. I think the self-created drives are key, where he can get in the paint on his own, even attacking a drop. So it's not just a pull-up. Even if there's finishing concerns, he could turn the corner and scoop. He could turn the corner and try and engage. That's important for Miami. I do think there is a world, and Memphis for the most part played dropped. You could see there was a little bit of inching sometimes to get to the level because they asked Terry Rozier, but it was mostly dropped. What intrigued me is with Miami's empty side actions, if Rozier and Herro are in the lineup at the same time, you look at who's one pass away. And so, yeah, you want to stay in a drop against Terry Rozier, that's fine. The help has to come from somewhere. If that comes from that wing, that's a kick to Tyler Herro, or that's a kick to Jimmy Butler. Does that, just that fact that we have to pay attention to you, open something up for you in a different way? Or even if he's in that position, he's getting a kick, can you get to more waves? Because, you know, hypothetically, you have the nights where Jimmy has it going, right? You got the nights where Bam has it going, or Tyler has it going. Pick two out of three. As a defense, do you go, hey, we can't let him start. Hold on. Wait, we can't let him start get going. Wait. So do you end up manufacturing attention that way? Because at some point, we need to take something away. Or do teams sit back? That's one of the things I'm trying to figure out. I think you probably feel good about the vision of him and Herro together and how you can go waves and side to side. I'm curious about transition with him. How many opportunities does he get? How much does he help them in that aspect? I was definitely encouraged by the defense, though. I thought he was very active on ball for Miami, very active off ball, communicating, good rotations. A couple times they were willing to switch him on to Jaren Jackson Jr. Keeping an eye on that. What's the switchability going to be like with Rozier? How are you going to handle defensively? Because eventually you're going to have two of Duncan, Tyler, and Terry on the floor. We can assume that, right?
Yeah.
So can you elevate and feel comfortable with what you have defensively there? But I think it's a plus. We're going to see what the base grows. I think the fact that he fits into what Miami likes and he wants to be there is really important. And now you can build on top of that as opposed to we're just waiting on you to score. Wait, what about the other stuff?
I feel that. Like, I think for me, like, the Well, quickly, just the laugh, because you noted this during the watch party. It's like, hey, Terry Rozier trying to set these pin-ins and stuff. That's cool. Season high 9 off-ball screen set by Terry Rozier. In the opener. Very much trying to... Very much trying to fit in. Like, let me make sure I make y'all better. Like, I'm just here to help. Don't mind me. I don't want anything I ate before I came. We cool. I'm here to help you move. So that portion was funny. To the drives portion, again, like, I think the burst pops immediately. If for no other reason, then it's like, huh, this is a little bit different than Kyle Lowry, huh? This is cool. As Terry Rozier was able to get downhill. Keeping an eye on the stagger stuff. Just because I want to see, like, how quickly he moves off of those. Because he's mostly flying off of staggers. At least going to, like, the Charlotte era. Like, he's flying off of staggers to catch the ball. Catch, hold a little bit, go into pick and roll, and then boogie from there. So I do wonder, in Miami with better talent and ideally with more counters and more cutting than what you would have seen in Charlotte, do we see those become, I'm flying off stack, I'm immediately shooting, or I'm immediately driving, and we're going from there? And is that going to be another way to create some of those organic catch-and-shoot opportunities if he's able to get downhill? So that's going to be interesting. The defense continues to intrigue me. You mentioned the ball pressure already. I was a little worried about some of the off-ball stuff, but I guess I wasn't as surprised, just because I'm the sicko that's watching Charlotte games while they've been this bad. So it's not like it popped out in the green, like, oh, whoa, this is worse than expected or anything like that. So we'll see with his comfort level in Miami how much better that portion of it gets. The Jimmy Terry stuff is where I am intrigued. Because if you noted, and as Terry has been just a really good ghost screener throughout his career, like, I think that's something that can pop late in game. I do wonder, like, how soon Miami prioritizes that portion of it. Because, one, it's the regular season. I don't know how often Jimmy Butler wants to shoot on any given night. So that's going to be a thing. But, two, and I really don't want to have the broader Miami offense conversation right now, especially since we're an hour into the pod already. But, like, there is, like, some hierarchy stuff that still needs to be sorted out with Miami just because of how weird the Bam Jimmy hero thing has been this year. And so I just kind of wonder, from, like, a locker room perspective, what happens if this turns into we running Jimmy Terry ghost screens to end games and Tyler's just spacing? That may be optimal. I don't know how that's going to smooth over as someone that, again, not reporting anything or anything like that. But, like, it's something that I want to keep an eye on over the next 3 months heading into the postseason. Like, what that portion is going to look like.
I got a counter for you, bud.
Okay.
I think there are going to be moments where it gets interesting, but I think them having more pieces they can use will help everyone. And I'll tie it back to one of the things that I liked about Kyle Lowry being in Miami. This is an opportunity for all these people to come together, but still be themselves. You got room to be aggressive, but you can still be you. On those nights where Jimmy doesn't want to shoot, guess what? He's got three other people willing to do it. If Bam doesn't have it or he's looking to swing, he's got options to go play with multiple people in handoffs. Terry feels like he's got a matchup where he wants to cook. He's got the room to cook. Same for Tyler Hero. So there's a functionality to it that could be a tricky balance at times, but could ultimately pay off to where we're not so reliant on the first part of this action to open everything up. We feel confident that even if you defend this, you now have to defend something else with one of these other guys. And that's where, okay, can the Heat find the lineups that are going to open that up? That's the thing about Miami. They are fully taking their lumps right now. So this is about as good enough a time to experiment and try and find some things that are going to carry you and push you through the stretch.
Can I ask you a quick Rozier question?
No.
Like, obviously blends into the Miami. Well, all right.
Yes, you can.
So we both kind of talked about, you know, the hashtag, what does it mean with Terry Rozier? And with the scoring, will he generate enough gravity or generate enough attention to draw a big up to the level or draw two, et cetera? I guess throughout his career, or just the recent career, how have you felt about Terry Rozier when he does draw two? Do you feel like he's handled that well?
In what sense? Because then it gets into context. Like, am I concerned that he won't be able to handle two on the ball?
That kind of did. Just general decision-making, processing speed when he does get to.
Brother, you watched all of Terry Rozier's passes 2 days ago. What do you think?
I guess my thing on that is, like, it's... I have concerns. I have some concerns, more so from like just the pure passing portion of it. Because I don't think he's a high-level passer. Both in terms of like, you know, firing the weak side skips and stuff like that. But even just general like pass placement stuff when he's pressured. I haven't loved it. He saw a high degree of it in Charlotte this year just because of, you know, LaMelo's been out. And if he's cooking, the defense is like, all right, cool, not you anymore. And so like that portion blends into the context of it. But like even within that, I'm just like, okay, how quickly is he coming off of it? Do we have the possession where he tries to string it out and then finds a roller? Like, what is he doing there? As, again, as you alluded to, as the sicko that watched a whole bunch of those possessions when that trade was made and then just watched passes from him. Like, it, funny enough, like, it kind of reminded me of the Hero bit when he finally started getting two. And it was like, oh, wait, so it's good news that he's drawing two. What exactly is he doing now that he's drawing two? We're not really getting the advantages we want out of this. Or these advantages aren't being maintained. Because it's a quick retreat, hold the ball, look for the pat, the outlet, one pass away. Defense recovers. Now we're just back against a set defense. So, like, I don't think it's going to be impossible for him to have that kind of impact. So I don't want to just say it's bad. It's not going to work. But, like, that isn't as... it's not as automatic as I would want it to be if I'm Miami. And so that's another thing that I want to keep an eye on.
Ah, you ready for a counter?
Sure.
Context changes everything, Nikias. You got that buy-in, he may be a more of a willing passer. I think one of the things that stood out, he may have been trying to fit in a little bit too much in game one against Memphis, but the decisions were quick. I'm getting off this thing quick. It wasn't a ton of bat dribble. Now, every now and then, he called for it. Hey, let me get this in transition. Let me pass and cut. Now, let's get this screen. But there's going to be a willingness to make some of those plays. When it comes to pick and roll, oddly enough, my concern is less two on the ball, those kind of passes. My concern is, okay, how does he develop this pocket pass with Bam? Like, say what you want about Kyle Lowry. He knew when and where and how to get Bam the ball in different scenarios. Duncan Robinson does the same. Tyler's developing that chemistry. Terry's got a jerkiness, quickness to his game, to where he may over-penetrate past that pocket. He may get a skip, but he may penetrate past that pocket. So how does that develop? Because you need to have that as part of it too, to where, okay, you're in a drop, I engage, here's Bam. Now you got to deal with that. That's where I'm trying to think, okay, what are we doing? But I purely just like some of the drives he can do if he gets a kick, that's going to help Miami.
I got you. Again, like not completely ruling it out. It's just like, okay, I need to see it translate. The context is better in Miami, but I would just like to see it translate. Just quickly on the numbers front on that side, as I was on the pick and roll rabbit hole with him, pick and roll possessions over the last 5 years, when he does draw two or gets a blitz or someone shows at the level of the screen, going back to the 2019-20 season, 0.89 points per possession on any of those trips, not ideal. 0.88 points per possession, not ideal. 0.97 points per possession in 2021-2022, which is solid, down to 0.9 points per possession last year, 0.87 points per possession this season. Just worth keeping an eye on the Rozier front if he draws two. But again, he helps. He is a bona fide scorer. Like, his presence alone should just make life easy for the three. I will say, zooming out, this is a positive trade for Miami. I don't want to give off the illusion that I hated or they messed up or anything. He's a good player and he will help. I'm more so being, I guess, more critical of it through like the championship lens that Miami wants to be in. It's like, okay, there are some playoff questions I want to see solved. But even to that point, as our guy Cooper Moorhead wrote about Terry Rozier, pick and roll scoring against switches, very efficient there. The clutch time scoring has been there for Terry for a while. So like that may mitigate a whole bunch of the concerns that I have. So we'll keep an eye on it indeed. Do you want to get into a couple of mailbag questions?
Sure, man.
We could knock out a couple as we're pretty deep into it. Quick thank you to those who send in mailbag questions. Continue to send those in. Dunkerspot@yahoo.com if you ever have a random basketball thought. Let's get this couple of questions since we got Wimby versus Chet yesterday. A couple of rookie fuse questions. One from Ben, who says, hey, Dunkers, I'm a longtime listener and first-time writer, feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here. Thank you once again, well, actually for the first time, for embracing a question of mine. I like the twist, we'll take it. The consensus around Rookie of the Year so far is Chet handily winning over Wemby. Maybe Wemby is opening the window a bit on the debate per say, our guy, Zach Lowe. The argument seems clear. Chet contributes more to winning and has better efficiency stats. Wemby has better raw stats. Chet wins. But what if Wemby were on the Thunder and Chet were on the Spurs? I'm sure Chet would still be balling, but can you imagine Wemby with Shea instead of Jeremy Sochan? No shade to Sochan. Shout out to Polish Americans. My point or question is, how much should voters factor in circumstances outside of a player's control when casting a ballot for an award like Rookie of the Year? I'm guessing the answer is not much. You judge the reality as it is. Hypotheticals be darned. But it seems like no one is asking how the two players would be doing if their situations were reversed. And I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
Did you do this because they just played each other? Or did you do this because I've been getting yelled at by Spurs fans for 12 days?
I just added it in because they played yesterday. That was the whole bit.
You reckon? Anyways.
It felt like a well-timed question.
Anyway,
felt well timed.
Okay, I just forgot to double check. So here's the thing, right? Here's the thing about doing award check-ins and doing award discussions. These things may sound or feel concrete in that moment, but to me, that's part of the fun of discussing it in that moment. You can reevaluate your thoughts. You can track progress. You can track different things. When it comes to Chet and Wemby and circumstances outside of a player's control, every award discussion, people are going to have to split hairs somewhere. People are going to have to find their tiebreakers. People are going to think differently because basketball is subjective. It's why they try to cast a wide net. It's why it's fun to talk basketball with certain people because, hey, there's no one way to win the game. There's different ways to win the game. I try to avoid one case being a negative on the other person. And I think there is a desire sometimes for a version of a consistent narrative. And I understand that to a degree, but I do think things can flow and change. And I think that's part of the reason why it's important to talk about it on the way. So you can note, hey, this is what I thought. This is what has changed. This is how I feel right now. The pure Chet Wemby swap, I personally can't get to because I feel like they are both in the right scenarios for them. Wemby has an open sandbox, a playground to a degree. And yes, it looks and feels a little bit more focused with him at the five, but the vision is to not box him in, which is why you have the fun usage of him on ball, him off ball, him spaced. Chet's got some talent, but that talent is a really good fit for OKC. Some people like to boil it down to, well, he's the third option. He's got Shea and Jalen around him setting things up, and I get that. But if Chet couldn't hold up his end of the bargain with the shooting, with the drives, with the timing on his cuts, with the defense, he and that team wouldn't be where they are. So when we go to a swap, I don't do a simple copy-paste. My mind goes to, okay, what would that actually look like? What would Wemby look like with OKC style? I mean, he'd still be Wemby, but how much of OKC is based on spacing? How much of Wemby is going to be spaced when they go guard, pick and roll? Like, what would that alter to what OKC does is where my head goes to. Mm-hmm. And then if you put Chet in San Antonio, would they have the same mindset offensively? Would things be as open? Would it be more structured? Would they be running more sets? Would it be more post-ups for Chet? Would Chet get some of the different kind of usage? How would that pop? How would defenses treat him in that scenario? Would his defense have the same impact in San Antonio? So my mind just goes to the different factors and the different contexts. I can only judge you off your scenario. You know what I mean? Everyone has different opinions. Some people say, hey, if you're the best rookie leading in this amount of categories, you're rookie of the year. I understand. It's hard to deny what Wemby does. It's hard to deny what Chet's impact is. What you got? Because I'm going to say something else.
Oh, I mean, if you want to say something else, you can.
Why is winning all of a sudden important in Rookie of the Year? It's not just that winning is specific to the Rookie of the Year. For me, it's specific to this race. Mm-hmm. Like, if the gap was closer, I don't think it would be a talking point. Y'all, I really don't. But one team is tied for first, and the other doesn't have a bunch of wins. I don't blame Wemby for that. They just don't. And one of the reasons why that team has a bunch of wins, because Chet's having an impact. So, yeah, that matters. If OKC was like a four seed and Chet was really actually succeeding off the strengths of others and not as consistent defensively, I think it would shift. I think if teams are able to switch more against OKC and it downgrades Chet's impact, or people are able to attack him on the other end and Wemby keeps putting up stat lines we haven't seen, that talking point gets quieter and the other stuff gets louder. It's how it works.
Like, to that portion, I can get into my whole spiel. Like, the thing is that it's rare for a rookie to be, it's rare for rookies to be positive impact players, period. It's also rare for rookies with sizable roles, even if you call Chet the third option, most rookies are not third options on good teams. Like, the reason that it is factoring in to this degree, to the why does winning matter now, because rookies generally don't contribute like this on winners. Like, that is that's a feather in the cap to Chet, not let's find a creative way to conspire against Victor Wembanyama. Oh, we got it. Win-loss record. No. That's not, at least, obviously, I can only speak for myself, or I can only speak for the pod, but, like, generally, no. Like, it's special because this does not happen often. And to that point, and no disrespect to these rookies, there's a reason why this argument is going for Chet and not to Hame and Derek Lively and some of the other rookies that are contributing to playoff teams right now. Like, there still has to be a level of, I'm doing this. And, like, as one of my favorite stats to keep track of over the last month or so, as this conversation is really starting to get hot, percentage of shots that are unassisted, so self-created. Chet Holmgren, 25.4%. Victor Wembanyama, 26.2%. There is less than 1% difference in terms of assisted baskets. I do not disagree that Wemby is the best player for the Spurs and Chet is not this team's best player. It is not Chet stand in corner, catch ball, shoot. Chet set screen, we throw lob, score. It's not just that with Chet. And so, like, I don't like that portion of it. Now, with that being said, to the heart of the question, I think the context would be weird if they were in different spots. And I think the shooting from Chet in particular is what makes it interesting for me to think about. Because, like, yeah, I would, you know, if we put the 2K hat on or something like that, I would love to watch Shea drives plus Wemby drives. And good luck with that. But to Steve's point that he hit on, like, I think about how often Chet is spaced before cutting or setting off ball screens or catching and driving. And I think about Wemby space, and it's just like, well, Wemby would get easier 3-point shots than what he's gotten in San Antonio so far. But it's not like Wemby is torching the Nets on catch and shoot opportunities this year. And if we go back to some of the Wemby streams we did over the summer, like something that we talked about and something that I brought up is like, hey, I posed the question to you during the broadcast. Like, hey, at what point do you start to, like, not necessarily worry, but, like, the brow raises with Wemby's 3-point shooting? Because I recognize the percentage is low because he's taking a bunch off the dribble, but there still needs to be a threshold for him to hit to really be a true threat out there and for defenses to care about him to that degree. And I think one of the things with OKC this year is that they have shot the ball collectively a lot better than a lot of people anticipated. Like, heading into this season for OKC, who are you noting as, like, just bona fide really good shooters for OKC, just on the roster, before heading into the year? It's Isaiah Joe and who else? Did you, like, trust would shoot 37% plus on volume this year? Is it just him? Like, we don't think of Shea like that. Jalen Williams has shot the leather off the ball this year, but heading into the year, you didn't anticipate that. And defenses still don't treat him like Steph Curry when he's spaced. You surely didn't think about that with Josh Giddey. Kerrich Williams can knock down shots. You know, I love him. He's not a high volume guy. And the rotation minutes flip for him. So, like, the fact that OKC has gotten this collective shooting from everyone is a part of why the drives have hit more, the cuts have hit more. The offense has been fantastic this year. If you insert Wemby into that and he doesn't shoot well, that may be a hit to the offense to a degree. He would make that up in other ways because he's Wemby and he's incredible, but, like, it'd be different. And for San Antonio, because Chet isn't the ball handler that Wemby is, or they don't trust him to just freelance the way that they let Wemby do it sometimes, the offense may be a little bit more structured. Do the pick and pops with Trey Jones hit a little bit more because Chet's a better shooter? Or because they're not saying Chet just run the offense sometimes? Is it more to Trey Jones? Is it more to Devin Vassell? Does Keldon Johnson feel more comfortable within the offense? Now, it's a different conversation if you should prioritize his comfort in the offense, if you're looking at long-term vision for San Antonio. But does everything else make a little bit more sense now because we're running a more quote-unquote traditional offense with Chet in? Maybe. Like, I don't think it's as simple as Wimby's averaging this, he's going to be this in this situation. It may prove to be right, but, like, I don't think that's a guarantee because of some of the intricacies between both of these teams. But I don't – it's fun. Now, with all that being said, if I can be honest very quickly, as someone who had Chet ahead when we talked, that's very much closing for me. Like, I don't think I'm far off from going, you know what, let's give this to Wimby because he's insane.
It was never a massive gap. That's the thing.
Yeah. At least for us anyway. Yeah. That's the fun. Do we need to shift our season schedule now? We just talk about the award races once and just give our final picks?
Absolutely not. I don't care.
Would that just make it easier for everyone?
No.
Y'all don't want that.
No.
You don't want
that. I don't care how much heat we get. I like doing it this way. It's a much better brain exercise.
Yeah, that's very much rhetorical. But like, would y'all prefer that to be the way that people handle awards talk? We just give final opinion and that's just it? It should be fun to say, hey, as of November 15th, we're here. As of December 27th, we're here. As of February 1st, we're here. And track the progression. It should be that versus you're wrong, you need to leave. And then if an opinion does flip, nah, stay on that side. And it's just like, what side? What are we watching basketball? I don't want to get into that whole rant. It's fine. But the follow-up rookie of the year question that we got from JP. Are we seeing anchoring bias in discussions of Wimby and Chet? I feel that early in the season, people got a specific framework in their heads to compare Wimby and Chet, and we haven't really seen that update yet.
What that mean?
Oh, go ahead. I love that reaction. Do you want the live reading of the definition of anchoring bias?
No, go ahead and give your answer first.
No, I was just going to say, like, I don't doubt that that's true for some people. And funny enough, like, very much anecdotal, not saying that this is 100% the truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God, or anything like that. Just from what I've seen, I feel like I've seen more anchoring bias to Wimby has to create a whole bunch of stuff and Chet's just spoon-fed and Chet is just benefiting from good team. I feel like I've seen more of that and no updating on Chet is driving more. Chet is posting up more. Chet is self-creating more now than he was in the beginning of the season. I would argue that not many people have updated on that portion of the program. I think there is a little bit of anchoring bias on both sides. And I don't think it's just the pro-Chet thing. Like, I think with Wimby, I don't know if everyone has kind of caught on to the usage changing a little bit since he's going to the five and what that's meant. So I think that is true. I don't think that's true for literally everyone. But like, I do think on both sides, there's some of that. And you see it when you see people arguing for Chet and you see it when people argue for Wimby, where it's just like, well, I don't think it's really that.
I think it happens more with the arguments based on some of the things I've seen as far as what they're arguing for or how they compare them. I don't think those have left. Mm-hmm. I think it's to human nature. It's this. So this should happen to a degree. Mm-hmm. Hey, Wimby's getting doubled all the time. Or hey, Wimby has this handicap. And well, hey, Chet has this or Chet does this. And you end up just going back and forth on those two things over and over again. I don't think it should affect the decision making. I think there are some things that are baked in with their case that will stick with them throughout the year. But I don't necessarily think it should just not evolve as the season goes on. Just because X is happening now doesn't mean, you know, I mean, if it changes, then hey, this changed. You shoot 70% in the restricted areas down to 55. Finishing's not as strong, et cetera, et cetera. It should evolve, even if you have a fundamental idea in your head. But no, I don't think it's changed. I think a lot of times people get stuck on point A or point B, And that's their fight, and they're going to fight that till the end.
Man, oh man. All right. Well, whoop that. Do you have any free throws?
Do you have any free throws?
I have like a, not very many, but I have like a few for what I carried over from the last pod.
Hit me with them.
I can sprinkle those in very quickly. Why do the Heat insist on stressing me out every January? Those were one of the free throws that I had. Naturally had that written out before the Terry Rozier trade, so that's funny.
Okay.
But that was one. Also Heat related. Who settles in on a starting lineup first, the Lakers or the Heat?
The Heat.
Okay. And then one thing we didn't touch on in the news cycle. How do you feel about the, if you saw the report from Matt Moore, that the Pelicans are open to moving Herb Jones? I don't think they're shopping him, but open to making that move. But how'd you feel about Herb Jones potentially being on the block? And if New Orleans actually pressed that button, where would you like to see him?
I don't think so. I don't mean that disrespectfully. It'd have to be a heck of a deal. I have no places I would want him to be at other than New Orleans.
I see. Herb's really good, y'all. Let that man cook.
Hey, let me tell you real quick. I'm a 63 overall with where do you want person X to land? I don't know.
Hashtag not the best. I feel you. I mean, that'll do it for me. We can roll over some more next week if you don't have any.
I have none. Hit the horns.
All right. Horns will be hit. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. But more importantly, join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. We are watching games live. If you have a league pass / cable subscription, you can watch games live with us. Real-time analysis. We got Steve breaking down why end-of-game plays did or didn't work. We're going into overtime stuff. If we have, like, smaller slates in the schedule, if it's like your random, if it's your TNT Tuesday and it's just those two games, then we're just breaking down plays throughout the game during commercial breaks and stuff. So it's really fun. Also, it is a place where you can kind of let your hair down, vent about your life, vent about your job, whatever's annoying you. Ask questions to us. We have people on stage. We get into Q&As. We just laugh about a whole bunch of stuff. We have so many elaborate bits within the watch party that I'm losing track of them at this point. But it's a lot of fun. The link should be hyperlinked in your podcast description. If so, just click on that link, enter your information. It is free, no shenanigans. And if not, copy and paste the link into your browser. Once again, it is free, no shenanigans. Come rock with us. Come watch some hoops with us. Come hang out with us. Have some fun. If you aren't subscribed to JJ Reddy's YouTube channel, you should do that. First episode of the week from us is always on the YouTube channel every Tuesday. Tuesdays are for the dunkers. So subscribe. Come support. Same version of the pod, but you get some plays sprinkled in on the YouTube version. So if you care about that portion where we're talking through Team X did this in the third quarter, we'll have a play going along with it. So we have fun there. But beyond that, we will catch y'all next week.
Nikai, it's great show. Shout out to Doggy Treat Wilkins.